today. Theresa May has survived a confidence vote, but this has been a disastrous week for her Brexit agreement. We take you to Westminster and Brussels to find out where it all went wrong. And, in opinion, The Guardian's Polly Toynbee argues that this is the moment for Jeremy Corbyn to embrace a second referendum. It's been quite a week for Theresa May. First this.
The ayes to the right, 202. The noes to the left, 432.
And then this.
To order, Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased that this House has expressed its confidence in the government tonight.
Hanging on as Prime Minister, but with her Brexit agreement in tatters. So how did we get here?
The moment that the election became effectively the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister taking complete ownership of not only Brexit, but actually what came across as being quite a harsh, hard line, strident Brexit, was the moment that sort of everything began to go wrong.
Theresa May's former Director of Strategy takes us on her Brexit journey, from the steps of Downing Street to a crushing defeat in Parliament this week.
Some very senior EU officials think a second referendum is the only solution. It's not a plan, some dark state, deep state plan to keep the UK in. They just want the UK to get on with it one way or another.
While The Guardian's Dan Boffey tells us how each stage was viewed from Brussels. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, how Theresa May's Brexit unravelled. Chris Wilkins, who became Theresa May's Director of Strategy and Chief Speechwriter in August 2016 and worked with the Prime Minister until autumn 2017, wanted her to be defined by what she said at the very start of her premiership.
That means fighting against the burning injustice that if you're born poor, you will die on average 9 years earlier than others. If you're black...
That speech on the steps down the street, which is now famously called, I think, the burning injustices speech. I mean, that is what she's all about. She feels that very, very keenly. And it was a speech that was then subsequently printed out and framed and put on the walls around Number 10 because it became the mission statement for the government. And the sort of tragedy of Theresa May, in a sense, is that she has a big, bold domestic agenda, and that was the reason she wanted the job. But of course, she got the job because of this other thing, Brexit, which probably ultimately is not something that really has ever animated her, but has nonetheless become the thing that will always define her.
Although it was in that speech and it was in her leadership bid. I mean, famously, she coined the phrase, Brexit means Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit.
Did you have anything to do with that?
So I took that on after the campaign and it became something that we repeated and then we rolled out. But obviously she was very quick to say that, yes, she was going to deliver on the referendum result. But I think even from then, it was only ever a part of her agenda, not the whole agenda.
You know, you go on about the domestic agenda, but it wasn't really about breaking down inequality, was it?
Yeah, I mean...
She voted for some of the, you know, really difficult welfare cuts that have come into practice. She famously is responsible for the hostile environment that has led to the Windrush scandal. She's absolutely determined that she's not going to change her mind in any way whatsoever on immigration targets, even though they're becoming increasingly unrealistic.
People point to her attitude towards immigration, which does, I think, define her in many ways. And, you know, I don't particularly agree with her approach on immigration myself. But I think it's important to understand where that comes from. And it comes from a belief that actually other politicians don't listen to what people say about that and what people want. And actually, you know, when you talk to people around the country, they do want control over immigration, and they want to know that, you know, the numbers are coming down, it's being controlled in a more manageable way.
Daniel Boffey, you're the Guardian's Brussels bureau chief. What did key figures in the EU make of Theresa May when she first became Prime Minister?
Well, to be honest, they didn't really know much about her at all. They'd watched askance everything going on in London, and they appreciated a bit of political cunning in Brussels, and they liked the way she'd outmanoeuvred Boris Johnson and the other Brexiteers. They had some concerns because she had previously talked of pulling the UK out of the European Court of Human Rights, and she hadn't really been a full-blooded Remain campaigner. But the first contacts with her were very positive. They regarded David Cameron as arrogant, and Theresa May was certainly not that. For all that she is, she's not that. And most importantly of all, and one cannot stress this enough, she was not Boris Johnson.
They really didn't like Boris Johnson.
They couldn't stand Boris Johnson. Everything about Boris Johnson, everything he said, and he was in Brussels as a journalist, didn't like him much when he was here. Certainly didn't like him as a politician.
Boris Johnson crossed the boundaries of a rational discourse, demonstrating political amnesia.
Do you think she regrets bringing into government hard Brexiteers like Boris Johnson and sacking Remainers like the former Chancellor, George Osborne, who, let's face it, held quite a grudge?
At the time, there was this sort of view that the cabinet always had to reflect the sort of balance between Brexiteers and Remainers and things like this. And that was the view that sort of coloured everything else. I don't really know where that view came from. I didn't really agree with it. But it certainly shaped some of the decisions that were made. And I wonder if she regrets that now.
You're setting her up as a Prime Minister who was desperate to take on burning injustices and for whom Brexit was a sideshow, except that very quickly she delivered speeches that were very heavily focused on Brexit, and most famously in that first party conference in October 2016, she said some stuff that really upset people.
Just listen to the way a lot of politicians and commentators talk about the public.
They find your patriotism distasteful, your concerns about immigration parochial,
your views about crime illiberal,
which was presumably what she was saying about the people who had wanted to stop Brexit.
Her analysis of the Brexit vote was that, yes, it was a call to leave Europe, but actually it was bigger than that. It was about people saying that politics wasn't working for them.
But it basically set her up as a hard Brexit Prime Minister. I mean, do you have any regrets about that speech?
Well, I would challenge the fact that it set her up as a hard Brexit Prime Minister, because I don't think it did. I certainly have some regrets about that conference speech, and there was a particular line that I now hugely regret, which was a line that was about the citizens of nowhere, which has become the famous line that everyone quotes.
But if you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what the very word citizenship means.
But the Lancaster House speech, the big Brexit speech, also felt pretty tough.
The thing about the Lancaster House speech is, I think if you look back at it and look at the language in it, the language is very important.
So today, I want to outline our objectives for the negotiation ahead. 12 objectives that amount to one big goal.
And then what subsequently happened, if you remember, was that the government was basically forced by Parliament to publish a white paper. And when the Department for Exit in the European Union wrote that white paper and published it, those 12 negotiation objectives had suddenly become 12 principles. And I spent all my time after that with press releases crossing my desk at number 10, and I'd correct it and say, no, they're not principles, they're negotiating objectives. And we went back and forth on that for a time. But they sort of hardened. Because a principle sounds like it's a harder thing than an objective. So language is really important. And then, of course, we went into election campaign, and in the election campaign you publish a manifesto where it becomes even harder still.
Those objectives that Chris Wilkins feels were wrongly turned into immovable red lines centred around the single market, the Irish border and the European Court of Justice. Dan, what was the reaction in Brussels to Theresa May's speeches on Brexit early on?
Usually Brussels ignores conference speeches. What goes on at conference stays at conference. You know, people do talk to the crowd. But that certainly wasn't the case for the 2016 speech. Yeah, I mean, it was the EU officials were watching it, analysing it. And it really did actually plant the seeds for everything that was to come. Straight after the speech, officials in the European Council and the Commission were drawing out decision trees, outlining what the Prime Minister's red lines would mean. They could understand leaving the single market, and that would end freedom of people, and that being a big issue during the campaign, and Theresa May had made it a big issue personally. Leaving the European Court of Justice had big implications, though, for security databases, sharing of data, so they had concerns about that. It would also have some trade issues. The big one, and the one that sort of set off alarm bells, was ruling out a customs union. They knew immediately, possibly more so than Downing Street, that this would cause a border problem on the island of Ireland, how to avoid a hard border if you're leaving the customs union. And so Ireland was right at the centre of it from the beginning on the EU side. So while Theresa May was sort of looking strong and authoritative and a party darling, and she got a stomping majority in the House of Commons for triggering Article 50.
British Prime Minister Theresa May officially triggering a Brexit, delivering a letter to the European Council in the last hour.
Wilford... Die had already been cast in terms of the big issues and how the division of Labour between the first phase and the second phase, and the two-year time talks was triggered with that in place.
So, Chris, by now you're Director of Strategy in Downing Street and a speechwriter. You're a pretty close aide to Theresa May. And along with her Joint Chiefs of Staff and their deputy, you were among those persuading her to go for an election.
It's not often in your life you get the opportunity to sit down pretty much one-on-one with the Prime Minister and argue for them to take such a momentous decision. We waited for Downing Street to largely empty of everyone else, and then four of us, myself and the two chiefs of staff and the deputy chief of staff, went upstairs to see the PM and her husband Philip. Each of the advisers who were there were given the opportunity to sort of state their case for why we all felt independently that an election was the right thing to do. And I think actually at that point the Prime Minister had been very much warmed up to the idea and was open to it, though obviously had considerable reservations. And as much as anything, it was really trying to make the case, I think, to Philip and to explain to him why we felt this was the right course for the Prime Minister to take.
Did he think it was a bad idea?
He definitely had the sort of largest reservations of anyone in the room. His point really that he made was that while he could understand all the arguments we were making, we also had to understand what a big risk it was for them as a couple. And he said that we had to appreciate that it had taken them years to get to the position of being in number 10. And we were asking them to put that all at risk. And obviously the polling at the time was good and the sort of environment was very positive. But nonetheless, it was a risk and it was a gamble and we all knew that. So it was about her getting a mandate for the reform agenda that she'd outlined.
When is the moment that you think, oh no, this election maybe isn't going to plan?
The real sort of head in hands moment, the moment I realised that sort of all the work that we'd done over sort of 9 months to get to the Prime Minister to a position where she could call that election, was about a sort of week after the initial announcement. And the Prime Minister came back from a meeting with the Queen at Buckingham Palace and walked into Downing Street, as Prime Ministers do on these occasions, to deliver a statement. And it was just after a sort of famous dinner with Jean-Claude Juncker, and some details of that had appeared in the press and things like that and had been leaked.
Reports that Britain's Prime Minister had begged for help with her Brexit negotiations at a recent private dinner in Brussels have
And the Prime Minister walked to the podium and delivered, was about to deliver what I thought was the speech that I had written, which was very much about, you know, a broad sort of optimistic vision of the future and a domestic agenda, and started delivering a speech which started laying into the Europeans and having a go at them.
There are some in Brussels who do not want these talks to succeed, who do not want Britain to prosper. So now more than ever, we need to be led by...
And I was just standing there thinking, well, I don't know where this language came from, and thinking, this isn't what this is supposed to be. She was supposed to be a unifying sort of national figure who could bring people together. And I think in that speech, then, because of the language she used, she became quite a divisive, slightly petty party leader, which was not the place that we wanted her to be.
And what we're saying is the Conservatives are the largest party. Note, they don't have an overall majority at this stage. 314 for the Conservatives, that's down 17. 266 for Labour.
When the exit poll dropped, 34. I mean, it was just one of those moments. I mean, it will be forever seared into my memory. You had to do a double take because it just didn't chime with anything else that anyone had said to us. And you sort of saw that the Conservatives were the largest party and thought, great, that's good. And then you thought, hold on, what, only the largest party? Where's the majority? I think nobody spoke for probably about 5 minutes. It was dead silence.
Dan, what was the reaction in Brussels to that shock election result?
Well, it certainly was a shock. They'd watched on and they didn't think much of Jeremy Corbyn and they assumed that she would come good. And it's a little known fact that Jean-Claude Juncker had actually encouraged May to hold that election. The Commission President had foreseen the danger of exactly the predicament we're in today. He knew that a hefty majority would be needed to sort of face down the Brexiteers and their demands. And so he, the margins of summits and meetings, he'd be saying, go on, Theresa, you can do it. But the result not only put her in the hands of the Brexiteers, it tied her fate to the Democratic Unionist Party, the sort of die-hard Northern Irish politicians who claim to win staring matches by cutting off their eyelids, is the worst possible thing. Every single decision since that moment has been 10 times more difficult. On keeping the issue of the Irish border open, the Irish government were able to persuade Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, that there couldn't be a technological solution. So, and Barnier said, yes, okay, Ireland's a member state, solidarity with you, so what's the solution? The solution, the Irish said, was for Northern Ireland to stay in the customs union single market. Barnier agreed, and you cannot think of anything more incendiary to the DUP. The DUP who are keeping propping up Theresa May. So, and then David Davis, when this proposal came out, Northern Ireland.
David Davis, who was the Brexit secretary at the time.
Yeah, David Davis then escalated things horribly by saying it was an attack on the EU's constitutional integrity, and the scene was set. And the rest, it was a complete recipe for disaster.
So, Chris, I think we should be clear at this point. After the 2017 result, you helped the Prime Minister for a few more months and then you left. But it seems to me that you think the election was a turning point that essentially brought about the unravelling of the Brexit strategy.
I think the way the election was conducted is basically the catalyst for everything else. Yes, I think the moment that the election became effectively the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister taking complete ownership of not only Brexit, but actually what came across as being quite a harsh, hardline, strident Brexit, was the moment that sort of everything began to go wrong.
So ultimately, by leaning into the right wing Brexiteer side of the Tory party and not reaching across the aisle, do you think Theresa May built up the problem that has finally defeated her in the House of Commons, that she wasn't doing deals across the aisle?
I do think that's the fundamental problem. I think the deal the Prime Minister came back from Europe with could have made it through the House of Commons. But in order to do that, she needed to spend much more time over the past few months reaching out to people and building a coalition of support. And that means reaching out to the mainstream of Conservative parliamentary party opinion and also speaking to moderate members of the Labour Party who could have been brought on board to vote for it. But actually, if you speak to those people, they say that they had very, very little contact from the government, from Number 10. And at the same time, every time the government is seen to give in to the right wing of the Conservative Party, it destroys another little bit of trust with those people.
So from this point on, can Theresa May rebuild the trust to get her majority in the House of Commons?
It's incredibly difficult to do that at this stage, but she has no other choice but to try. But it's going to take a real, I think, change of approach and going back to what it should have been from the start, which was about reaching out to people across the aisle, but actually also beyond Westminster and into the country. You know, part of the original premise when we started out on this journey was that she should always be not so much the leader of the Conservative Party, but the leader of the country. And what we didn't want to do was actually privatise the problem of Brexit within the Conservative Party. That's subsequently what has happened, but actually there is a majority in Parliament, I think, if she's prepared to reach out.
Dan, what is the reaction in Brussels to this week?
What I want is that as fast as possible we know what the position is.
So they expected the Prime Minister to lose the vote, but the scale of it really is dismal. I mean, they feel like 2 years of work seems to be blown away by the Commons in an evening session. You know, if it'd been a smaller defeat, then some tweaks or even some quite substantive changes might have sorted it all out. But they don't even think it's about the backstop anymore. They think that that's a mask for the real problem. A majority of MPs in this parliament either want a no deal or they want no Brexit. And so there's just not a way through. I mean, Tusk said a deal looks impossible in reaction to the result. So the position now is a waiting game. Some very senior EU officials think a second referendum is the only solution. But that's honestly not a plan, some dark state, deep state plan to keep the UK in. They just want the UK to get on with it one way or another.
Dan, thank you very much.
Cheers, thank you.
That was Chris Wilkins, the former Director of Strategy and speechwriter to Theresa May. and The Guardian's Brussels bureau chief, Daniel Boffey. You can follow his reporting at theguardian.com. Coming up, could it be now or never for a second referendum?
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian subscriptions.
Now, The Guardian's Polly Toynbee on what Labour does next.
No one's surprised. She's won the confidence vote. Nobody ever thought that her own party would be mad enough to go for a general election at this stage in proceedings. Labour's official policy, agreed by its conference, is that they would go for a general election. And of course, they genuinely want a general election. But if they can't get one, then everything's on the table, including a second referendum. And a second referendum is very much what's favoured by the membership. Of course, Labour should sit down and talk to her and maybe genuinely hope that she would offer some much gentler, softer Norway-type option. I don't think she will. I don't think she can, because the moment she did that, she would lose half her cabinet and half her MPs. She's caught in a vice. And so I don't think she'll do that. If she did, it would put Jeremy Corbyn in a bit of a fix. When the time comes, Labour cannot be seen to be aiding and abetting this country going into a Brexit in any shape or form. Brexit is a Tory project that was started decades ago by the Tory fringe. Finally, David Cameron called the disastrous Brexit referendum. It's the Tory party that's in real trouble over it. It's not a Labour question. I don't see much point in Labour waiting to go on and on having more confidence motions. They've got to decide now, make that tough decision about what their policy really is. We don't really know Corbyn's private thoughts, but we think we glimpse them as to be essentially anti-Europe. He says he voted Remain, so we should believe that. And when it comes to it, he has to obey his party members, his whole political past. Tony Benn was his mentor. The campaign for Labour Party democracy has been about putting power in the hands of the membership. And that's what he's done since he's been leader. Well, you know, over 80% of his members want there to be a referendum. And three quarters of them want to vote for Remain. And he can't possibly turn his back on them. A second referendum becomes a great deal more likely if Labour and its leadership are strongly behind it and are making the argument up and down the country in some of those Leave seats as well as all their Remainer seats, and are making the case for it, making the democratic case for saying, you the people, you've got to make your minds up now. And I think that it is possible there would be enough Tory MPs who would support a motion in favour of a second referendum if some mechanism is found, which I think it will be, by which Parliament itself can begin to put forward motions and not just wait for Theresa May to do it.
You can read Polly's columns at theguardian.com. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Rachel Humphreys and Amar Callier. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.